Thank you. Morning, everyone. Okay, shall we try that again? Let's wake you up a bit. Morning, everyone.
Morning.
Ah, that's a lot better. At least I know I'm speaking to somebody. So let's try and put Judges into some sort of context for you. Let's take it right back, shall we? Let's take it right back to Egypt, okay? The children of Israel, they come out of Egypt. This is freedom for them. Great. They travel out of Egypt. They come right up to the borders of the Promised Land. And the people go to Moses and they say, before we go into the Promised Land, let's go and spy it out first. Big mistake. Because God had already promised them the Promised Land. He'd already said to them, this is the land that I am going to give you. All you need to do is go in there and take the inheritance. But the people wavered, didn't they, in their faith? And they wanted to go and spy out the land for themselves. And so what happens? They send the people into the land, don't they, to have a good look round. And all the report that comes back is that the land is full of giants. We're like grasshoppers compared to these giants in the land. And the cities that we've seen, the walls, go up to heaven. How can we possibly take the giants in the land? And straight away, their faith started to ebb away, didn't it? All those ideas of going into this wonderful land, a land filled with milk and honey, and the grapes that they brought back, all of a sudden, that was no more a reality because their faith had let them down. And so therefore, God punished them, didn't he? He said, right, for 40 years now, you will wander around the wilderness and you will not go into the land that was promised to you. And once more, this generation will die out. And so Moses takes them on that journey for 40 years of ecclesial life, okay? And sometimes ecclesial life is like that. It's testing. It's hard. People fall out. People groan. And Moses having to keep this group of people together, enthusiastic, trying to worship God. And he brings them then back to the borders of the land after 40 years. And God says, okay, last time that you were here in this situation, what were you scared of? You were scared of the giants. You were scared of the big city. So what we're going to do first and foremost is we're going to deal with that issue. So what does he do? He takes them to fight against Og. Og, king of Bashan. Og was a giant of a man. It tells us in the scripture that his bed was 9 cubits long by 4 cubits wide. It was made of iron. This man was a giant. 4 cubits, if you imagine your bed at home, it's probably double the length of that and double the width of your bed. It's a huge bed. So God says, you've got to learn to put your trust in me. You've got to learn to be able to defeat the giants in your life. Go and fight against Og. And the people do so. They fight against Og. They fight against Sihon as well, the king of the Amorites. The next test, God says, okay, you're scared of those big cities with the big walls? Okay, what I'm going to do is we're going to go against Jericho, a huge city with huge walls. And what's going to do, you're just going to march around it. But ultimately, I am going to fight the battle for you. So when the people go into the land and the walls fall down, they can trust that God is there with them. And Moses, on the banks of the River Jordan, he delivers an exhortation to them, which we have recorded as the book of Deuteronomy. Okay, it's an encouragement to them. And what Moses is saying in that is he's saying, now you've got to live a life of faith. You've got to go into the land and you've got to defeat the rest of the giants in the land and you've got to take those cities. But I'm not going to be with you. Aaron the priest, that spiritual leader, has already died. Miriam, that mother in Israel, has already died. And Moses now is just about to be taken away from them. Where is the leadership going to come from? And all eyes look at Joshua. Joshua now was the man who was going to take them over the Jordan into the land. And they go into the Jordan and they fight their battles. And now Joshua then, coming to the end of his life, and now he is concerned, what's going to happen to this people when I die? Let's have a look. Let's go to Joshua chapter 24. Joshua chapter 24, and this is Joshua telling them the stories. We like stories, don't we? We like stories that mean something to us. Because at the moment, you go to Sunday school, you go to your youth groups, you go to your youth weekends, you go to the meeting. And all the time, the speaker tells you about stories, don't we? We tell you about stories in the Bible. Sometimes what you need to hear is personal stories. You need to know the stories of your family, of the people in your lives. You need to know the stories of how they came into the truth. Because when you're born into a family, aren't you? And everyone's already a Christadelphian for most of you. Some of you may have come via a different route. But you're born into that family and you think, well, this is just how it is. Okay, I'm born into this family, therefore I become a Christadelphian as well. Okay. But what you need to know is the journeys that people go on. And we had that wonderful video, didn't we, last night? And I missed most of it, but I saw bits of it, about the journeys that these people have gone. And had you just met them in an ecclesial setting, you'd have just accepted them, wouldn't you, as a normal brother and sister. You don't know the background to them. And so, therefore, Joshua tells the people the journey that they have gone on and how that at every stage of that journey, God has been with them. And he's been by their side and he's been there to help them. And so chapter 24 is all about that. And he comes to then to the conclusion, verse 14. Now therefore, fear the Lord and serve him in sincerity and in truth, and put away the gods which your fathers served on the other side of the flood and in Egypt, and serve ye the Lord. This whole chapter, there are 14 serves in there. So if you look for the word serve, you'll see it 14 times. Serve the Lord, serve the Lord, don't serve the other gods. And what the irony of this is, when they went into the land, they served everything apart from God. They served all the other gods of the land. The thing that they didn't serve, though, is God. And verse 15 then, and if it seem evil unto you to serve the Lord, choose you this day whom you will serve, whether you serve the gods of your fathers served that were on the other side of the flood, or the gods of the Amorites in whose land you dwell. But as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. And the most powerful thing that you have is choice. Choice is such a powerful thing, isn't it? Because if you make the right choices in your life, right, like these people being asked to do, then God will be with you. And he will be with you right up until the kingdom. If you make the wrong choices in your life, that doesn't mean to say that God will give up on you. It doesn't mean to say that he will desert you. But you are making it so much more harder for yourselves. And so therefore, Joshua says, I've made my choice already. Me and my house, we're going to serve the Lord. What's your choice going to be? And all the people, enthused by these stories and enthused by Joshua, they say at the end of their verse 16, and the people answered and said, God forbid that we should forsake the Lord to serve other gods. End of verse 18, we will also serve the Lord, for he is our God. And it's as simple as that, isn't it? We'll serve God as well. But Joshua knows better than that. Because what did Joshua say in verse 19? And he uses this reverse psychology, doesn't he? He says to them, you cannot serve the Lord, for he is a holy God, for he is a jealous God. He will not forgive your transgressions nor your sins. And what he's saying to the people here is he's turning it around on them. And he's saying, you're not going to be able to serve God, are you? Because he's not going to be able to forgive your sins and your transgressions in the land if you turn to other gods. And the psychology works, doesn't it? Because all the people say, in verse 21, and the people said unto him, no, that's not the case. We will serve the Lord. And Joshua said unto the people, then, okay, you are witnesses. Verse 22, ye are witnesses against yourselves that ye have chosen the Lord to serve him. And they all say, we are witnesses. Verse 24, and the people said unto Joshua, the Lord our God we will serve, and his voice will we obey. So you can't get more of a commitment than that, can you, from the people? He says it to them over and over again. Are you going to serve? And the people say, yes, we will serve, and we will obey. And Joshua says, okay then, see this big rock here under the oak tree at Shechem? What's the oak tree at Shechem? What's symbolic about an oak tree at Shechem? Does anyone know? Oh, by the way, you can answer me. You can interact with me if you want. If you don't know the answer, that's fine. Have a guess. Anyone know what's symbolic about an oak tree at Shechem? Jacob? Okay. When Jacob is escaping, if you remember, from Laban, and Rachel carries off her father's gods, Jacob comes to the oak tree at Shechem and he says, you need to bury all your gods. Put them away. Cast them away, because now we're going to serve the true God. And so therefore, the oak at Shechem is significant. So Joshua gets this big boulder and he says, this is going to be the witness between you and me and between God, to say that what you are going to do is you are going to serve the Lord your God. And everyone says, yes, let this rock be the witness. Did they do it? Let's read on. Verse 31. And all Israel served the Lord all the days of Joshua, and all the days of the elders that overlived Joshua, and which had known all the works of the Lord that he had done for Israel. So the people did do it. They did serve the Lord until Joshua died. Let's just turn over now to Judges chapter 2. And we get a little pricey then of what we've just discussed there. Verse 6 of chapter 2. Verse 7, sorry, of chapter 2. And the people served the Lord all the days of Joshua and all the days of the elders that outlived Joshua. So it's sort of pricey-ing what we've just read there in chapter 24. And they buried Joshua, verse 9. What happens after Joshua? Well, verse 11. As soon as Joshua dies, and the children of Israel did evil in the sight of the Lord and served Balaam. And they forsook the Lord, the God of their fathers, which brought them out of the land of Egypt, and followed other gods, of the gods of the people that were round about them, and bowed themselves unto them, and provoked the Lord to anger. And they forsook the God and served Baal and Asherah. You see, going into a new land is hard, isn't it? Just think of our Iranian friends and our visitors that are coming. It's difficult coming into a new land. And you have to adapt sometimes. You have to change the way you do things. What God was saying is, you're going into a new land. I expect you to continue to follow me. But when the people are in the land, that's a lot harder, isn't it? And all of a sudden, these people now were to become farmers. They'd never done farming before. They'd never had a land before. How were they going to get their harvest through? Well, they were going to maybe depend on the people of the land to tell them. Maybe they were going to start joining in and worshipping the gods of the harvest and the gods of the field, the Baals and the Asherims, because they knew that they were the gods that were going to bring them a plentiful harvest. So you can see how things work, can't you? All of a sudden, the people start to integrate themselves into the existing culture, and they start to turn to the gods that the people of the land are worshipping, because the people of the land are saying, if you want a good crop this year, you need to start worshipping these gods, because these are the gods that will help. And all of a sudden, the people start to worship these gods of nature rather than the God of heaven. And so then, at the beginning in chapter 1 there of the book of Judges, it tells us then, verse 1, after the death of Joshua. And now all the people now have gone to their inheritances, and they are now expected to fight to gain their territories. And in Judges chapter 1 there, it gives us a rundown of all the tribes and how they went on in their inheritance. And it's a regression. Because as we go down all the different tribes, the first few tribes did quite well. Okay, they managed to take some of their territory. Verse 27, we're talking here about Manasseh. Now, Manasseh, verse 28, and it came to pass when Israel was strong that they put the Canaanites to tribute and did utterly drive them out. So when Israel was strong together, when they were the united, they were able to drive the force out. When they were fragmented, that's when the difficulties came. And there's a really good spiritual lesson for us there, isn't there? Is that when we are united and we meet together and we have a common purpose and we have a common centre of worship, then together we are strong. When we start to fragment, when we start to argue amongst ourselves, when we start to disagree, when we start putting ourselves maybe in isolation, and you guys are going to start making those choices. I don't know whether some of you have already moved away, maybe to college, maybe to work, I don't know. But it's really, really important that you choose where you're going to go. Because if you're putting yourself in isolation or in places where there's not a solid ecclesia or there's not young people your age, you are going to make it so much more difficult for yourselves. Make sure you go to places where there are young people, where there are a good ecclesia, so that you can have that unity. And so as we go down this regression, what happens, verse 29, neither did Ephraim drive out the Canaanites. In fact, the Canaanites dwelt in Giza among them. So the Canaanites were dwelling with the Ephraimites. End of verse 30 there, we've got Zebulun, and the end of verse 30 it says the Canaanites dwelt among them as well and became tributaries. But as we go down the list, what happens then, verse 32, the Asherites dwelt among the Canaanites. And you recognize the difference there is that the earlier ones, the Canaanites were dwelling amongst the Israelites. Now there's a reversal. It's now the Israelites dwelling among the Canaanites. And then finally, we go all the way down to Dan, verse 34. And the Amorites forced the children of Dan into the mountain, for they would not suffer them to come down to the valley. So right at the very end here, we've got this tribe of Dan, which incidentally was the biggest of the tribes, one of the biggest of the tribes that went into the land. And they were given a fairly small size of land. And the biggest tribe could not force out the Amorites. In fact, what it tells us is that the Amorites were so strong that they forced the Danites up into a mountain and wouldn't let them come back down again. Okay? So, we have a regression here of what the tribes were able to do, and they're a reflection, really, of their faith. So it's a fine line, isn't it, really, between how do we serve God in the right way? And Judges is all about that. Judges is all about there is a right way to serve God, and there is a way that you think is right, but actually is wrong. And we'll have a look at a good example of this, how that people think they were doing the right thing, but actually they were doing completely the wrong thing. I looked at Wordle of Judges. I thought it'd be interesting. I didn't put in all the words myself. I got this off the internet. But you're all familiar with what Wordles do, don't you? They look at all the words in a passage, and the most common words that come out are bigger. I thought, well, I wonder what it says about Judges. And we've got some really key words here, haven't we? We've got the Lord, which we would expect to find in a book of the Bible. We've got Israel here, and we've got the people. And that's really what Judges is about. It's about this relationship between the Lord, Israel, the nation, and the people and the land, isn't it? And this is all about God's relationship with his land and with his people. It's interesting there, there's another word that comes out here is hand. And what does hand mean in a biblical context? Well, hand is symbolises doing, doesn't it? When we're doing an action, when we're doing something, the Bible sort of phrases it as though we're doing it with our hands. It's an active word, isn't it? But hand is also about deliverance, and it's about being delivered into the hands of the enemies, but it's also about being delivered from the hands of the enemies. So right in the middle of this, you see God's hand at work. And God works on two ways, doesn't he? He either brought the enemies in order to teach the Israelites a lesson, or he brought a saviour in order to get rid of the enemies in the land. And some of you will know that Judges is there's six cycles within Judges, and it's this cycle of sin, judgment, and repentance. And so we have a period then of prosperity, and prosperity is a dangerous thing, isn't it? Prosperity is, because when everything's going well, when you haven't got any enemies to fight, when you've got enough money in your pocket, okay, and your crops are coming in, what happens then? What happens is you then start to forget about God. And that's no different to our lives. We tend to find that when things are going well, we forget to pray to God. We forget to talk to him. But when things start to go wrong in our lives, all of a sudden then, that's when we start praying. That's when we start turning back to God. And no, it was no different, because what happened then is they turned to idolatry. They were oppressed then by an enemy, because God brought that on as judgment. The people then, all of a sudden, turn to God. They cry to the Lord. And throughout the book of Judges, the people continually cry to the Lord. God raises a judge, the oppressor is destroyed, and then we come back to this cycle. There's a period of peace, the people start getting comfortable again, and then they go round and round again. But what's interesting is this was a cycle that was getting progressively worse. Okay, it was gradually getting worse and worse and worse. Don't stare at that for too long, or you'll start to get hypnotised. Okay, I can already see a few glazed looks in the audience. But don't get hypnotised by it. But the idea is that as Judges progresses, it gets worse and worse and worse. 12 Judges in the book of Judges. Easy to remember, isn't it? 12 apostles, 12 disciples, 12 tribes of Israel. So it's not a coincidence, I don't think, that in the book of Judges, we are told that there are 12 judges, and I've dotted them around here. There wasn't exactly one per tribe, but you can see that they're fairly spread out. Actually, there were 14 judges in total. Who are the other judges that don't... anyone else know? There were two other judges, not in the book of Judges. Somebody said an S?
Samuel.
Who's the other one? Eli. Okay, it said Eli judged as well. So there were actually 14 judges, but within the book of Judges. What we're going to look at today and tomorrow, we're going to have a look at Gideon. We're going to have a look at Jephthah. We're going to have a look at those today. Tomorrow, for our exhortation, we're going to sort of loosely base it on Samuel. And then tomorrow afternoon, we're going to have a look at Samson. I thought it'd be interesting just to have a look at some of the numbers that we've got within Judges. It tells us that 8 times throughout Judges, they served other gods. Okay? It tells us 7 times that they did evil in the sight of the Lord. 6 times there was a cycle of sin and repentance. And 5 times they cried unto the Lord. Okay, so that's the bad side of it. What about the good side? What did they do for God? And it's pretty grim reading, really. Throughout the whole of the book of Judges, there is no mention of priests, Levites, the tabernacle, worship, prayer. except for in the last four books, the last four chapters, which actually come right at the beginning chronologically of the book of Judges. And all these mention here of priests, Levites, Shiloh, they're all in a negative way. They're all in a negative context, okay. So, when God spoke to Joshua about going into the land, he said, it will be a priest-driven society. Okay, so you will have a leader who will be guided by the priest, who will be guided by God via the Urim and Thummim. Okay, the sort of the stones or the dice that they used to roll, the priests, when they wanted a decision from God. And they told Joshua, all your society will be based around a God priest driven society. And yet in the whole of Judges, we don't get a mention of them. Not at all, except for in a few relatively small passages. It only mentions there that they serve God twice. In the whole of the book of Judges, it mentions they serve God twice. There's only one mention of worshipped, and that was by one of the judges. And there are no mentions at all of prayer. So it just gives you an indication, doesn't it, in the book of Judges about how deprived this nation was of worshipping the true God, despite what they signed up to with Joshua. So the theme of this weekend is, out of weakness were made strong. And it's interesting that as we go through the book of Judges, deliverance is brought about by weak things. Okay, and I have to say that in a way that doesn't offend. I'll tell you about that in a minute. Okay, so deliverance was brought about by these things. Does anyone want to shout out some of the things there that they may know about Judges already, and what those symbols relate to? Anyone?
Samson.
So, which one's Samson? Okay, so we've got the jawbone of the ass. Okay, so Samson brought about deliverance by a jawbone. Okay, that's hardly something that's strong. It's not like a sword, is it, or something strong like that. It was by a jawbone. What else have we got there?
The ox goad.
The ox goad, okay. Shamgar, okay, defeated an enemy with a stick. Okay, you can't get much weaker, can you, than a stick. What else have we got there?
Gideon.
Okay, so we've got two symbols for Gideon. We've got two for Samson as well. I'll come back to that one. So we've got Gideon, the earthen vessel, which they held the torch in, if you remember. And it's quite a good symbol, that is, because we know with earthen vessels, they crack, they shatter. They are weak, inherently weak, aren't they? And we've got 300 men here. So rather than the 32,000 men that turned up for battle, God said deliverance isn't going to come from the large army. Deliverance is going to come from a small army. Coming back to Samson then, blindness. Okay, so Samson was blind when he delivered Israel from the Philistines. So again, a weakness. What else have we got here? We haven't just this one then, this one or this one, or this one. What else have we got? Sorry, what was that? Who said?
Ehud.
What was the weakness in Ehud? And I say, I've got to be careful what I say here. What was the weakness with Ehud?
Left hand.
Who said left hand? Left hand, yes. So what I'm not saying is that anyone that's left-handed is weak. Okay, and I'm not going to arm wrestle you later to prove that. But in our society, left hand is always perceived as the weaker hand because the majority of us have got a right-handed. And certainly in biblical times as well, that was the case, wasn't it? It was the Benjamites that had left hand. But also a dagger, again, a little implement, so weakness. What about this one?
Jail.
Jail and the tent peg, again. Jail, and again, no offence here, a woman. Okay. Driving a piece of wood through the temple of Sisera. Okay, now that does not say that women are weak, okay, but in fighting terms, okay, If you were killed by a woman in biblical days, and even today sometimes, it is seen, isn't it, as though a sign of weakness. All right. What about this one? Do you know this one?
A millstone,
you're right, with a millstone. Do you know what happened with the millstone in the book of Judges? Exactly right, yeah. So Abimelech wasn't actually a judge. If you remember, Abimelech was Gideon's son who decided to take over from Gideon. But what happened is, he sees, if you remember, he goes to fight against the city and an old lady comes along. I don't know whether she was old or not. She comes along and she finds this millstone and she thinks... And it fell on Abimelech's head. Again, so again, weakness. What's this one? Anyone know? What deliverance was brought about by rain and flood? We're not told directly, but have a guess. Okay. Deborah and Barak. Okay, now, we're not going to look at Deborah and Barak, but there's a suggestion in Deborah and Barak's song that... Deborah's song, in that what happened is, if you remember, the armies that came against Barak had chariots. But it talks about in the song about the rain, okay? And there's a suggestion there that the rain came, it flooded the plain, and therefore the chariot wheels couldn't go any further. So deliverance then brought about by an element of God. Okay, so, you see then that the whole of the book of Judges is about... how that really the people didn't have to do anything because God was going to do it all for them. And that's a lesson we've got to learn, that when we look at all of these judges, there was nothing special about them. Okay, even when we get to Samson, when we think Samson was this great big strong hulk of a man that could go and beat everybody up. Okay, my opinion is that he was probably a bit weedy. He was probably a bit like me, okay? He was a normal person, a little man, okay, who God used in order to bring about deliverance. And it was the strength of God that came upon him that made him strong and able to deliver. So at a time then when the Israel were weak spiritually and physically, God was able to work through these weak things in order to bring about deliverance so that they could trust in him. Okay, let's go to our reading, Judges chapter 17. How am I doing for time? Oh, okay, we've got time. Go to Judges chapter 17, and you may think, why am I starting at the end of the book of Judges? And the reason I'm starting at the end of the book of Judges is because, chronologically, the last few chapters of Judges actually should come right at the very beginning. Okay, and I don't think we're going to have time to explain why I think that. But there are certain indications in the book of Judges that do tell us that it should come at the beginning. For example, Judges 18 verse 12, it talks about a place when the Danites go looking for a new inheritance. It says that they went up and pitched in Kirjath-Jearim in Judah. Wherefore they call that place Mahane-Dan unto this day. Okay, so... we read about that place in Samson. So when Samson is there, that place has already been named. So we know that this record here in Judges chapter 18 must come before Samson. Another good indication in Judges chapter 20 and verse 28. We get a mention of Phinehas. And Phinehas the son of Eleazar. So we know who Phinehas is. And we know that at the end of the book of Joshua, Phinehas is about 60 to 70 years old. I can't remember the exact age of him. But considering the period of the Judges is about 300 odd years, that would make him 370 years old if this was the same Phinehas. So this record must come at the beginning of the book of Judges. And just finally, Judges chapter 18, which we're going to have a look at, verse 30, and the children of Dan set up a graven image, and Jonathan, the son of Gershom, the son of Manasseh. Now, if any of you got a modern version for verse 30, what does it say instead of Manasseh? Moses, okay. So most commentators all agree on this, that Manasseh is an incorrect translation here. And the suggestion being is that the writers were so embarrassed by the fact that Jonathan was a grandson of Moses that they added an extra, I think it was a nun, to the Hebrew in order to change it from Moses to Manasseh, because they were embarrassed by the fact that this man Jonathan, which we'll go and have a look at, did these bad things and he was associated with Moses. So the modern versions say Moses, but the point I'm talking about is that Jonathan was the grandson of Moses. So again, it can't place it at the end of the book of Judges. It has to place it at the beginning of the book of Judges. Okay, so let's go into Judges chapter 17, and we're going to have a story here about two people, a tribe, who decide to do things their own way. And what I said at the beginning is there's a fine line, isn't there, between doing what we think is right, but what is actually completely wrong. Now, who wrote, do you think, the book of Judges? Who do you think might have written the book of Judges? Samuel, well done. See, you do know the answer. You do know the answer. So Samuel probably wrote the book of Judges. And there's some indications in there as to why. In the book of Judges, we get the mention of Jerusalem, for a fact. We get the mention of the destruction of Shiloh. So it must have been somebody that lived after Jerusalem was established as a city. And we know that Jerusalem wasn't established as a city with the name Jerusalem until David conquered it. So it must have been after David. Samuel would have known about Shiloh as well and all the things that happened there. So we think possibly then Samuel wrote the book of Judges. And what he's doing then is Samuel is looking back on a time that is completely different from the time that he is now writing in. So the time that Samuel was writing in was a time when things were established. The kingdom was in the hand of David, the king. Okay, so there was a king over Israel. There was a system of worship in place. There was a temple that was about to be built, depending on when Samuel wrote it, whether he wrote it during the days of David or later. But there would have been a temple that was in getting ready to be built in Jerusalem. So everything was going well. Now, what Samuel is doing now when he's recording the book of Judges for us, he's looking at a time when things were completely different, when people were fragmented, when people were doing things in their own might, when there was no organized system of worship in the country. There was no central place where people could go to. Now, you could say, well, there was Shiloh, and there was a tent in Shiloh that people could have gone and worshipped, but nobody did. It's not even mentioned. People, as it says in chapter 17, were doing what was right in their own eyes. There was no king in Israel to bring about that structure and that worship. So Samuel then looking at a time and doing a comparison. This is how it was, and now this is how it is. How much better it is now with David the king, a man after God's own heart, a system of worship, and all the enemies subdued round about. So let's have a look at this man, Micah. Micah, it tells us, is an Ephraimite. There was a man of Mount Ephraim whose name was Micah. And he said unto his mother, the 1,100 shekels of silver that were taken from thee, about which thou cursest, and spakest of also in mine ears, behold, the silver is with me. I took it. And his mother said, blessed be thou of the Lord my son. So this is a man, and we know he's a grown-up man because he's got old children, who stole off his mother. Who would steal off their mother? And what's more, 1,100 500 shekels of silver. So this isn't just about stealing the odd pound, okay, from a pot. This is about stealing a whole inheritance. 1,100 shekels of silver, which this man takes, and then he admits to. Okay, so he says, "Mum, that silver that went missing, well, I've got it. Hands up, I'm going to give it you back." And she sort of blesses him for being so honest and opening up and handing it back. But the important thing is, what does then happen with that money? Well, what she says then, well, this is money that I have going to devote to God. But how I'm going to devote that money to God is I'm going to make graven images. So you can see here that there is this idea that really we should do something in order to be religious. We should do something in order to worship God. How do I do that? Well, let's just make a little shrine. Let's make some images to go in that shrine, and let's set it up in the local community so people can come and worship at this shrine. And that's what they do. And Micah there in verse 5, "And the man Micah had a house of gods and made an ephod and a teraphim and consecrated one of his sons who became his priest." Well, what gave him authority to consecrate one of his sons as a priest? Because we know that only a son of Aaron could be a priest. So again, Micah is now taking things into his own hands to set up his own little church, to set up his own idols in that church, and what's more, to set up a priesthood. And this is called having a religion of convenience. It is about saying, I want to worship God, but actually, I want to dictate how I worship God and how I do things. Okay, can we think of any religions maybe that are like that, where they make up their own rules? Okay, because that is a religion of convenience. And we can see then how this is now starting to spread in Israel. People are doing what's right in their own eyes because there is guidance from nowhere else. Because for all intents and purposes, Shiloh and the priesthood doesn't exist. It's not given any direction, and there is no leader in charge, there is no king in charge, in order to say, this is what you need to do. So people make it up on their own. So he appoints a priest. Verse 6, "In those days there was no king in Israel, but every man did that which was right in his own eyes." Then what happens? Well, we have this Levite that comes along, and we know that we've just looked it up who this Levite was. This was Jonathan. Jonathan, the grandson of Moses. Now, why was a Levite wandering around Israel trying to find work? It tells us there in verse 7, "And there was a young man of Bethlehem, Judah, of the family of Judah, who was a Levite, and he sojourned there. And the man departed out of the city from Bethlehem, Judah, to sojourn where he could find a place." Now, those words there where it says he could find a place means where he could find work. "And he came to Mount Ephraim, to the house of Micah, as he journeyed." So it gives us an indication as to what was happening with the Levites as well. There was no priesthood in place, and therefore the Levites were out of work. And if you remember, when they went into the land, Joshua said, "I will allocate certain areas of land for the Levites to live in." And what had happened is, because the tribes hadn't taken that land, now the Levites didn't have any land of their own. So they were homeless, but they were also out of a job. So you've got now this man, Jonathan, who's wandering around trying to find work, trying to find somewhere to stay. And the only thing that he's got in here on his side is that he's famous. He's famous because he's the grandson of Moses. So he's hoping that somebody will give him a job. Well, Micah is overjoyed, isn't he? Verse 9, "And Micah said unto him, Whence comest thou? And he said unto him, I am a Levite of Bethlehem, Judah, and I go to sojourn where I find a place. And verse 10, Micah said unto him, Dwell with me, and be unto me a father and a priest. And I will give thee 10 shekels of silver by the year, and a suit of apparel, and thy victuals. So the Levite went in." Micah was overjoyed because now not only did he have his little church, not only did he have his graven images, but he now had a real Levite as his priest. Not only that, but he calls him a father as well, doesn't he? Be a father and a priest to us. And that's interesting, isn't it? Because Jesus says, call no man father apart from your father who is in heaven. And again, we can see where this is going, is that people setting up their own religions. And so therefore, he turfs his sons out of the position and puts Levite in. And what's more, verse 12 and 13, Micah consecrated the Levite, and the young man became his priest, and it was in the house of Micah. Then said Micah, now know I that the Lord will do me good, seeing I have a Levite to my priest. So this was a perception that people held, that if you could get some idols, you can get some graven images, you could get a church, you could get a Levite, then it would make God look on you more favourably. And how wrong is that? Because we can't strike up a relationship with God where we say to God, if I do all these things and I do them my own way, in a religious way, then you will bless me. Because that's not how it works. With God, it is that you worship him how he wants to be worshipped. And that's how you will be blessed. Okay, so now we've got this happy situation, a church, a shrine, with a Levite. Then come along the Danites. Now, we've already looked at the Danites, haven't we? How that the Danites were unable to take their inheritance. And that gives us a bit of an indication as to what the Danites were like as a tribe. Maybe they were unfaithful. Maybe they liked to take the easy option. Okay. Anyone know who the mother of Dan was? That's a hard question. Do we know where Dan came from? Shall we have a look? Let's have a look at Genesis chapter 30. Genesis chapter 30, verse 4. Now, this was Rachel trying to have a child, if you remember. And she couldn't have a child. So what does she do? She does it her own way. Right? And that's really important. Genesis chapter 30, verse 4. And Rachel gave Jacob Bilhah, the handmaid, to wife. And Jacob went in unto her, and Bilhah conceived and bare Jacob a son. And Rachel said, God hath judged me, and hath also heard my voice, and hath given me a son. Therefore called she his name Dan. So, Rachel, deciding to do things her own way, doesn't trust in God that he will give her a child. So she tries to manufacture this situation where she can have a son via Bilhah. And when Bilhah gives birth, Rachel says, God has judged me. God has done it. And he's looking favourably on me because we've now got a son. That was completely wrong, wasn't it? Because she'd done it her own way. So this is the roots of Dan. And Dan does things his own way. And I've just noticed that we're running out of time. So let's quickly go back to Judges chapter 18. And let's just finish this off. Judges chapter 18. Now, this tribe, Dan, were unsettled. They didn't like what they had. They didn't like their little inheritance because they didn't take it. So what they wanted to do is they wanted to go and find another inheritance. So they all wandered off, and they wander off up to the north of Israel. And they stumble across a place up here, which is called Laish. So they come all the way from down here, Dan, and they wander up here through Ephraim, which is where they come into contact with Micah and the Levite. They wander up the Jordan Valley here, go over here, and they come across this place called Laish. And let's have a read about Laish, verse 7 of chapter 18. The five men departed, came to Laish, and saw the people that were therein, how they dwelt careless, after the manner of the Zidonians, quiet and secure, and there was no magistrate in the land. Zidon. Who came from Zidon? Jezebel came from Zidon. Okay. So this was a place that had adopted the religious worship of the Zidonians. What's more, it says that there was no magistrate, so there was no air of restraint. People just basically did what they wanted to do in this place, right? And so when the Danites saw this, it appealed to them. Well, look at this. This is a place with no enemies round about. We can just pounce on this unsuspecting people, take the land, and we can start to adopt their culture. And then it goes on to tell us that Dan do this. They take this land. On their way through here, they take Jonathan from the house of Micah. So they've now got a priest. They take him up here and they establish themselves then in Dan. And then what do you go on saying at the end of verse 18, chapter 18 then, in verse 30? And the children of Dan set up the graven image. And Jonathan, the son of Gershon, the son of Moses, he and his sons were priests to the tribe of Dan until the day of the captivity of the land. And they set up Micah's graven image, which he made all the time that the house of the Lord was in Shiloh. Now, I wonder whether that graven image was in the form of a calf, a golden calf, maybe. Because we learn later on when Rehoboam takes the kingdom from Solomon, if you remember, when Solomon dies, Rehoboam and Jeroboam set up their opposing nations. Jeroboam takes the northern kingdom, doesn't he? And Jeroboam says, you know, to save us having to go down to Jerusalem, let's set up an altar here and an altar, Bethel, where's Bethel? Here, at the north and the south. Let's set up an altar there and we'll put priests there to serve. Now in Bethel it says that they had to appoint priests because there was nothing already set up there. It doesn't say the same as Dan because there were priests already there that were willing to serve at that altar. These were the priests that were the legacy of Jonathan, this Levite. And so this is where idolatry starts in the northern kingdom of Israel. And it's interesting, when you go into the chronologies of the tribe of Dan, they are missing from Chronicles and they're missing from the list in Revelation. It's almost as if God has written Dan out of the book of life, because it was from here that idolatry started in the northern kingdom and it spread its way down through that northern kingdom. And as we know, Israel was taken away first. And so we've come to the end. Time has run out. But hopefully what we've done is we've tried to establish what things were like in the period of the judges and how people did things their own way because there was no other instruction or guidance from anywhere else. So people did that which was right in their own eyes.